This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 10 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Today, we're going to take a hard look at the SpaceX Starlink program, one of the first of its kind, and already a mainstay in the night sky. And it's also, I should say, a hot topic within the community of stargazers and researchers. There are now thousands of these small satellites orbiting the Earth with plans to quadruple that number in the near future. But before we get to this most interesting topic, well, let's not forget that we have a couple of updates that need some attention. And Steve, why don't you go first?
We know that historically the fall season heralds colds and flus, to nobody's surprise. What is a surprise, though, is that scientists have confirmed that over its 26 years of operation, strains of human bacteria on board the International Space Station have mutated from their original form and adapted to the environmental rigors of near-Earth orbit. Now, one might wonder where those germs came from, since we know that space components are built in near-sterile conditions. But considering that over 270 different astronauts and cosmonauts have lived on the ISS for 26 years, there's no doubt about the source of those germs. A recent edition of the New Scientist magazine reports that NASA has been monitoring the ISS's microbiome for over a decade to understand how our human microbes survive in space conditions and, get this, what threat they might pose to astronauts' health. Researchers have isolated numerous unique ISS bacterial strains and have noted genetic changes which seem to offer protection against the increased radiation and microgravity experienced on board the station. Those adaptations include changes to proteins which assist the bacteria in repairing their DNA which has become damaged by radiation. And understanding how those bacteria do that could have positive benefits for space exploration and health, but there is the very real potential that these new bacterial strains could pose health issues for astronauts. The bacteria can also form biofilms of slimy layers which stick to surfaces and can help bacteria resist antibiotics and disinfectants. Just as overly moist bathrooms and showers breed mold and bacteria, astronauts will need to make more effort to control moisture inside spacecraft to prevent the growth of those biofilms. For long-duration missions such as trips to Mars, monitoring the microbial population and their genetic traits will be crucial to safeguarding astronaut health from extremophile bacteria.
You know, I was thinking that 1950s science fiction movies were passé, but I guess not. Now, speaking of health, though, we know that the three astronauts and one cosmonaut who returned to Earth on SpaceX's Dragon capsule, they had been spending more than 200 days in space, but they were not as healthy as expected on their return. In fact, they were hospitalized for unreported issues. Now, three were quickly released, and one remained for observation. Now, to protect the crew members' medical privacy, NASA's not about to give us many details. We do know that there are concerns for one of the astronauts who's currently in space.
And I believe, Tim, you're referring to the two Starliner astronauts, Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore, who unexpectedly had their planned 8-day mission extended until February 2025. Now, first, we should be aware that astronauts need to consume a high-caloric diet rich in meat, and they must consume about 3,500 to 4,000 calories each day. This is due to the caloric demands of living in space and microgravity. And to do so, they must maintain a daily 2.5-hour cardiovascular regime, such as tethered treadmill running. And this is to counter bone density loss because of microgravity. And a 2014 NASA medical report says that women experience greater physiological challenges than men. For instance, they lose more blood plasma, which temporarily boosts their metabolic rate and caloric burn. They also lose muscle mass at a higher rate than men.
The issue here is Sonny Williams began the mission weighing 140 pounds and has lost significant weight. Unnamed NASA officials are said to have described her as becoming skin and bones, having lost a lot of weight, and now has noticeably sunken cheeks. They've also said, quote, it's a priority now to stabilize her weight and hopefully reverse this drastic change, unquote. It should, however, be noted that 59-year-old Sonny Williams is a seasoned astronaut, having previously spent some 479 days in space aboard other missions. And during that time, she's conducted 7 spacewalks, making her 5th on the list of the most experienced spacewalkers. The ISS has been in the news quite a lot lately, Steve. There is the concern over astronaut health. There is also some good news, though, about the first use of SpaceX's Dragon spacecraft to boost the ISS into higher orbit, something they have to do from time to time. And up until this first flight using the Dragon spacecraft, for years the ISS had to rely on help getting a boost from a Soyuz spacecraft. But I wanted to mention one other ongoing ISS issue that's been in the news, and that's leaking air into space and putting the entire ISS mission into some risk.
And I understand that this leak problem goes way back to 2019. So there's history there. So how about giving us some details about these leaks?
Well, as you say, the first leaks were detected way back in 2019. And they knew at that point that there was a problem in the Russian sector near the service module transfer tunnel. In 2020, the loss of air was getting worse, and that prompted an investigation. NASA got onto it, and they published a report in 2024. And he said at that time that the leaks had become a top safety risk. So also later in this current year, NASA on Roscosmos fessed up that there were 4 cracks and 50 other areas of concern. I mean, you think about it, that's a big concern.
You know, it's one thing to be dealing with leaky windows in your house, letting warm air out and cold air in. And say, by the way, according to the second law of thermodynamics, cold air doesn't come in, warm air goes out. But okay, we get the drift. Having air leakage in our houses is one thing. In space, it's a whole bigger issue. And so it falls into 3 sort of categories. First of all, you have to notice that there's an air leak, find it, seal it, and then somehow recharge the air supply. Give us some specific about these ISS leaks.
It is a matter of quite great consequence here. At its peak in April of this year, it was losing 3.7 pounds of air per day. Now, they've got that down to 1.2 pounds per day, and that's quite a significant bit of progress, but it's also still an ongoing loss. The Russians have agreed to keep the hatch closed that leads to the troubled spot. And I think the key point here is the severity. NASA has now rated this level risk on a scale of 1 to 5, saying that these leaks are a 5.
Can you tell us how they patch up these leaks?
Well, they're using any number of means, including tape. And I know some of these stories about using tape sounds like, what's that product we all use?
duct tape.
Duct tape. Yeah, I don't think they're using duct tape. But I wanted to mention that they do have ways of resupplying oxygen into the space station through tanks of pressurized oxygen. They also can recycle urine and condensation and then also use electrolysis to split that water into oxygen and hydrogen. But let's move on to the topic of the day, which is Starlink. Now, first off, I think we need to review and cover off some of the basics, some of which may come as a bit of a surprise to listeners. We're now about a decade into the history of Starlink, and it was announced back in 2014 by SpaceX. It was initiated in 2015. The goal was to provide low-cost, high-speed internet to remote corners of the planet. And Starlink is a constellation, shall we say, of small satellites. There are several different sizes ranging in mass from 200 kilograms to over 2,000. By the end of 2022, Starlink had about 1 million internet subscribers and is now estimated to have about 4 million. So, Steve, I was a little bit curious about this when I was doing some research to think, you know, what are these people paying and what are they getting? It seems pretty outlandish to me, but it actually reads like some kind of promotion you might get from Telus or Rogers. For a cost of $120 per month, a residential customer gets unlimited data, high-speed internet, and in remote locations. That's got to sound pretty good. and they also have plans for people on the move. They call them roaming plans, not surprisingly. And once again, the price is a little bit more than the basic residential. It's $165 US per month, but they promise coverage wherever you go, including what they call coastal regions.
And with Rogers recently unilaterally increasing its subscription rates, I suspect Starlink may become more attractive to many viewers. However, if we stop right here, this sounds pretty benign. After all, it wasn't that long ago that quite a few companies were offering satellite-based internet and TV services such as Bell Direct, Hughes, and quite a bit more. And I believe there was a time when you subscribed to that. So how is this different from those? Why do we need so many satellites to cover the globe? And this all sounds pretty science fiction-y.
Well, I think you're right, Steve, that it is science fiction-y, and that the satellite services that I recall subscribing to were, you know, one satellite dish beaming a signal, and you aimed your receiver at it. And this is, as we said, thousands of these mini satellites, which are able to provide coverage to a much broader area and at much higher speeds, higher quality. And because of the ability to launch these mini satellites into space with the reusable technology that some companies like SpaceX have, it's in a sense, the opportunity was there, and it became a matter of who could be first into the marketplace. Let's get into a bit about the numbers of what's going on up there. There's no real boundary on the number of satellites that can be sent up by SpaceX or anybody else. There's no rules. You don't have to particularly apply to somebody in the United Nations. And so you've got different companies, different organizations, whether it's China or Europe, all trying to get into the business. And of course, there's some of the companies are Amazon, for example. So you've got Elon Musk and his SpaceX. You've got Jeff Bezos and his company, Amazon. They've got something called Project Kuiper. That's their name for their project. And they have a plan to put about 3,000 more satellites in space. There's a firm out of the UK called OneWeb that I looked up recently, and they've hooked up with a company, a larger firm called Eutelsat. They have 634 satellites, and they got a head start on Starlink, but they made a mistake, Steve. They put all their launch eggs into the Roscosmos basket, and then after the invasion of the Ukraine, well, all of a sudden there was no more launches and no refund. So that one didn't work out quite as well in the near term, but they're certainly making plans to do more. And there are similar ventures that I came across. And of course, the Chinese have plans too. It all adds up to tens of thousands of new satellites, all going up ostensibly to provide affordable high-speed internet to every corner of the planet.
It's really, truly unbelievable. And there are website animations where you can take a look at the satellites in low Earth orbit. And the poor old Earth looks like it's pockmarked with measles or something like that. And I know that you and I remember when there was exactly one satellite around the Earth, and that lasted for a couple of weeks and then it deorbited. So this is all very strange. The promise of tomorrow, eh, Tim? Well, it turns out you can actually see that promise in the night sky whenever there's a new train of satellites whizzing overhead on a clear night. And if you haven't seen one, the first time you do, you will be absolutely amazed. I remember my first time, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I said, what is this? And if it was a science fiction movie, you know, you'd say, the aliens are coming. Here's the invasion fleet. And when you see them, you go, well, okay, why tonight? Will they be here in the same spot if there's a clear sky tomorrow night? So you have to wonder about the orbital period of these things. And whenever SpaceX sends up a new batch of satellites, it seems they line up in what is sometimes called a Starlink crane. But after a while, they start to disperse into a new pattern in low Earth orbit, and they become less visible as standalone satellites.
Well, think of the clutter and the debris, the risks of collisions in space, and the risks of colliding with other satellites. Much to my amazement, these Starlink satellites have collision avoidance systems. So they actually can maneuver, but you have to ask yourself, how long are those systems going to work? I don't know. What about the quality of those systems, or those that might be then used down the road by the Chinese or Amazon or anybody else? Just what do we know about a guy who's willing to operate tens of thousands of satellites in space? I know you've looked into that, man. What do you have to say?
Well, I do know that politically He seems to be on one end of the spectrum, but from an entrepreneurial and workplace point of view, there are some pretty positive things about him. We do know that he's unemotional, introverted, and he's self-professed to be on the autistic spectrum. He's exceptionally motivated and self-driven. He's a serial entrepreneur. He started up PayPal, and I believe he made $165 million when he sold that off. We know he's involved with Tesla after buying into it. We know he started up SpaceX. He's a hardcore workaholic, and he's interested in three major areas, namely space, clean energy, and the internet. And he genuinely wants to change humanity. Well, change it so much he wants to put them on Mars. He enjoys hiring new talent, but does not accept those which are not team players and will get rid of them in a flash. I've seen videos of him working at the ground level with fellow engineers, looking at rocket engines and making up design changes for the Raptor engines. And he believes in self-analysis and critical thinking. And above all, he's a risk taker and a change agent. So he does get some bad press, but it's certainly not all bad.
Well, he's a complicated fellow, all right. Now, there's lots of people who like him and lots of people who don't. But here's another way to put this confusion about his personality into perspective. He's made fortunes running an electric car company that threatens the foundations of the carbon-based truck and car empire that is in turn backed by the oil industry. He's got a huge head of steam on the development of driverless car technology. So here you have a huge swath of his fan base are people in the oil industry, traditional car industry, truck drivers for a living, and so on. All of these folks who could be in for a very rude awakening if his stated ambitions are realized, they could find themselves out of work. But this is a show about the science of space research and space travel.
In this episode, Tim, we're taking a hard look at the history of Starlink's success and the concerns with this business model that's based on tens of thousands of satellites orbiting the Earth. Now, let's not forget that Starlink is not the only corporate player in this business, but to date, there's little doubt that Starlink has a huge lead on its competitors. And the number of Elon Musk's mini satellites approaches 10,000. And it's becoming controversial among astronomers. Now, we've got a clip to play with former NASA scientist Emma Gatta, and she was interviewed by the BBC. Dr. Gatta has a lovely but strong accent, and I hope listeners can still follow her as she's got a really important perspective on this issue of satellite proliferation.
Now, researchers say that radio waves from Elon Musk's growing network of satellites are blocking scientists' ability to peer into the universe. The scientists say that the new generation of Starlink satellites, which provide fast internet around the world, are interfering more with telescopes. They say the thousands of orbiting spacecraft may be hindering astronomical research. Well, SpaceX, which owns them, hasn't commented. With me is Dr. Emma Gatti, a former NASA scientist and editor at Space Watch Global. Thanks for joining us. How much of a problem is this?
Well, it is a problem. Hi, Gita. It's a problem because radio astronomy especially relies on the ability to see stars very far away, very far distant from us. And with all these satellites, they're basically blinded because the satellites are so much closer to Earth than what they're trying to observe. So it is a problem indeed, absolutely.
Obviously, the satellites have a function in terms of providing fast internet, often to troubled parts of the world. How could this be sorted out? Should it be regulated? Is it regulated?
So it's a kind of complex answer, because what is regulated is the fact that satellites cannot transmit in certain bands. So certain bands, radio bands, are completely off for satellites. So theoretically, these bands are reserved for science. The problem is that we have in so many satellites that they kind of emit as a sort of mistake. So it's not the satellites that is emitting, because theoretically it cannot, but all the equipment, all the electrical circuits in the satellites are kind of producing a backdrop of emission. And this is impossible to regulate. They cannot stop it. And this is where the problem arises. So it's a kind of like secondary effect.
Okay. And so what sort of research is not being able to be carried out as a result?
The entire field of radio astronomy is struggling completely, because We are at the moment having 11,000 satellites, and they are really struggling. And we plan to have 100,000 satellites in 10 years. So you can imagine that this means fundamentally a complete stop at the entire field of radio astronomy. Radio astronomy is that kind of astronomy that is using radio frequencies to observe the farthest object in our universe. So that's an entire field of science that is struggling, and it will struggle even more.
You say that they sort of blind the researchers and therefore they can't see. Is it as simple as that?
So there are two ways in which a satellite can disturb. It can visually disturb because the satellite itself is not a bright object. It doesn't have any light, but if it gets hit by the sun, it becomes bright. So it can disturb what we call visual astronomy. But then it can also disturb through radio emissions. So yes, several ways to disturb.
Well, that made sense to me. Obviously, having so many of them has got to cause some problems. But I didn't really think about the pollution from the gear on board those satellites impacting other parts of the sound spectrum and interfering with radio astronomy. And it seems that with no regulations in place, what are we going to do when the number of satellites rises from 10 to the expected 100,000 in the next decade?
You know, Tim, first of all, people cannot fathom the number 100,000. As we've talked before, our brains can only see the number five, objects up to five in number. If you've got five marbles on the desk, you look at it and you go, oh yeah, that's five. You put down seven, people don't know how many that is. They have to go, well, there's three, there's four, oh, seven. 100,000? It's beyond me. And so I guess that we're talking about, pollution of sorts. I know that if you just look from an optical point of view, if you live in the city, you can't see the stars very well at night because of light pollution. Many municipalities have changed the kind of lighting system that they have to a softer type, and they also have downward lighting as opposed to lighting which goes in a, let's say, 360 degree arc. So light pollution does bother ordinary people just looking at the stars, but now we're talking about satellite pollution. So thanks to good old Microsoft Copilot, it's come up with some analogies to help explain the impact of thousands of mini satellites. So here's a couple. The party noise analogy. So imagine you're in a quiet library trying to study, but a loud party is happening right outside the windows. Even with the windows closed, the noise seeps in and makes it hard for you to concentrate. Similarly, radio telescopes are trying to detect faint signals from space, but the strong signals from the satellites act like that noisy party, and they interfere with the telescope's ability to pick up those faint cosmic signals. Now, here's another analogy. Perhaps for those of us of the slightly older persuasion, static on a radio analogy. Now, some listeners may be familiar with the tuning of an AM radio to a distant station. You might hear the faint voice of the broadcaster, but suddenly you get a lot of crossover static because somebody nearby is using a powerful walkie-talkie. The radio astronomy equivalent is when a radio telescope is tuned to listen to the universe, but the signals from the nearby satellites cause, shall we say, static, and it interferes with the ability to clearly receive the information from distant celestial objects.
Those are really good analogies, Steve, and it is important for us to try our best to think about 100,000 versus 5 or 7, because this is very much a reality. This is something that is happening now and will continue to happen, and the impact is already being felt. It's not something where you say, you know, the temperature will rise by 1.5 degrees Celsius and in a certain number of years, the Earth's atmosphere will... You can see the changes in the Earth atmosphere now and the weather patterns. And similarly, you can see the impact. Scientists are seeing the impact. Those that are working on the Hubble telescope have already been reporting issues about the quality of the signals that they're able to achieve. So we're not talking about a future impact. We're talking about a current problem and one that's going to get significantly worse with time. And I have to say that this issue reminds me of a term that economists have used. We've mentioned it on the show before, the tragedy of the commons. You imagine a street that you live on and everybody's got a really nice garden or lawn in front of their house. They take care of it. They're out there on the weekends tending it. They're buying flowers to put in the front to set off the neighborhood with a good look. But there's a certain amount of garbage that starts to get thrown or fall out of cars, windows, or what have you on the street, and it blows into the nearby park, into the common area. Well, who's supposed to clean that up? If nobody cleans it up, the pile of garbage just gets higher and higher. People stop using the park. And where are you then? And in a similar kind of way, here we are with business people and national parties players putting all these little satellites into space. And there's really no one to say, you know, have you really thought about the impact what you're having is on scientists doing astronomy or people wanting to look at the stars? It's a tragedy because there's no one in place to say, here are the rules and you have to abide them. I don't know, Steve, it seems to me that the science and the potential of launching all these satellites is getting ahead of our ability to understand what the side consequences are. And I think we're beginning to realize they're many in number.
I think there's probably three main players now in satellites: the military, commerce, and science. And unfortunately, if you look at it as a pyramid, commerce seems to be at the top of the pyramid, but I never underestimate the military aspect. So those two are at the top of the pyramid, and way down below is science. And poor old science is trying to pick out pristine information from the cosmos, and it's being totally interfered by the other two.
We're butting up into this story so often and under different headlines that you go back not that long ago and the emphasis was on the science of space exploration or space travel. And, you know, we've made jokes or even done episodes on the occasional advertising for a pizza company or a Coca-Cola company. It's almost like a sidebar issue or sidebar story. But the world's changing and science is changing. Economics of space flight and space travel and so on are profoundly changing. And the thing is that most people aren't paying attention to this. And, you know, they look up in the sky and they see about 10 satellites flying overhead. It's like, you know, I wonder what that was. They have no idea. And they certainly have no idea of the implication this is going to have on the future of science and the future of their ability and their children's ability to look up and enjoy the skies, the heavens above.
While you were talking about this, an idea just popped into my mind, or not an idea, but a recent news item, that there are certain universities in England, believe it or not, that are dropping English literature courses because there's not enough interest in it. People are getting their access through media, TikTok and whatever, and there's just no interest in reading about great authors in the past or concepts or ideas. And so similarly, as you said, science used to be this almost a pristine search for the truth, and it's being pushed off to the wayside. You really, if it wasn't for people like you and me who were diligently searching for new topics about science and space and inroads being made.
Well, that's a great way to bum out the audience today, Steve. And
aren't we positive today?
Aren't we positive today? But hey, we're telling the truth. And you know, that's probably all the time we have today to talk about this topic. I hope people do carry out their own research on it, and we'll take it from there. So I have to say, that's all the time we have for this episode of Space Talks. And this is Tim Woods in Brentwood Bay.
And Stephen Lowry here in Salmon Arm, and saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?